You're Connected is the official audio and video podcast of the Miami University Alumni Association, available exclusively to the organization's dues-paying members. This podcast features a lecture from Reunion College held during Miami's reunion weekend in June 2007. Dr. Jillian Okenfull is an associate professor of marketing in the Farmer School of Business. She is in her ninth year at Miami. Her research focuses on understanding brand meaning, brand management, and effective marketing practices for gay and lesbian consumers. Jillian teaches the Laws, Hall, and Associates and Marketing Strategy Practicum courses and is co-founder of Brandfort Associates, a branding consultancy. Sit back and enjoy this lecture from Dr. Okenfull. Best of all, there will be no quizzes.
Thank you. I think it's actually just gotten warm enough outside that it's actually more pleasant to be in here than to be out there, but thank you for being here. What I'm going to talk to you about today is really our global marketing course squashed into 50 minutes. So if I go too quickly, because I'm trying to get too much across to you, just tell me to stop and we'll just pace it as we go. But I taught the global marketing class here I've been here 9 years, and for 8 of those years, I taught global marketing, mainly because of my background. So what I wanted to do today was to give you a little introduction to marketing, to global marketing, and then just talk about how complex it is. And this heading really at the bottom here is that there's no way I could teach, or I can even teach my students in a semester, everything they need to know about how to do global marketing without having blunders. All I can do is really teach them what they need to look for when they go into a new country. So we teach them the importance of different factors, and then when they go in, they have to actually look for those factors. So next summer, we're actually going to be taking a group of 50 students around Europe where we're going to be doing an actual field study where they have to go into countries, they have to direct it themselves, and actually do an audit for a brand and come up with suggestions for how that brand goes into the country, which I've done in my course, but done it from Oxford, Ohio, which is hard to really get that real feeling. So I'm going to attempt to just give you a little bit. As I said, if I go too quickly, just let me know. So this is what marketing is. How many of you were marketing majors or work in the field of marketing? Okay, I've got a few people I can hit upon then. So this is marketing strategy. So when you're going into a country, these are the things that you would do. You would go in and you would look at the population, you would look at their needs, you would look at how they would use a product, look at the benefits that they would like, and you'll segment the market, which means that you look for a group that you would want to sell your product to. Then you decide how you actually want to target that. And then you're going to decide, how do you want to speak to them about your brand or about your product versus the competition? So how do you position your product to them? Now, you marketing majors, what are the ways that you have of doing this? What are your tools? Okay. So you're actually going to go there and learn about it. And then when you go there, what do we call what you actually implement? It's the thing that we'd like you to have tattooed on your arm when you become a marketing major. Do you remember the four P's of marketing, right? And the one thing I was always scared about when I started teaching is that I'd only remember maybe 3 of the P's my first day of marketing. So what are the 4 P's?
Product,
anybody want to chip in? And price. All right, so those are the 4 P's. So you decide who you're going to target, you decide how you want to position the product to them, and then the tools that you have available to you are, how do you design the product? What is it? What features do they want? And they vary from country to country. How do we need to price it? And we'll talk about income and income distributions and how that would affect it. How are we going to promote it, which is a big thing when you're talking about different cultures. And then distribution, probably the prickliest of them all. And you would need somebody who's actually a logistician to come in and talk about that, and which is what I do in my class, because there's so many different things in the infrastructure that go along. So I'm going to just touch on some of these things. But as you look at this, if you think about a company, they don't get to do this in a vacuum. So if you were in the US, in a domestic environment, they'd need to look at what their competition was, because they need to look at how they want to position it. They'd need to look at the economic climate, how much money do people have to spend. They'd need to look at political and legal forces, what type of laws are on the books, those types of things. And it gets even more complicated, as some of you know if you've traveled, when you go abroad. And now this is what we're looking at. So again, we've got competition. So we've got competition in the US, then we've got different competition in when we go abroad. We've got the type of technology. So for example, do people have access to the internet or not? What type of technology is there in manufacturing, all those different things. Again, economic forces, which are going to change as you go from country to country. The structure distribution. I'll show you some pictures which will bring that to life in a little bit. Geography and infrastructure. If you think about it, if you're making cars, if you're making a car, and Ford has learned this to its detriment, if they're going, for example, to the Middle East, they found that the sand underneath was eroding all of the chassis in their cars, and they found they had to make them of a different material. Even if you're packing something, if you're going into somewhere that's got a really wet, humid atmosphere, you've got to package it differently than if you were going into a dry atmosphere. So the geography and the infrastructure is going to be effective. And then political forces. And basically, that's the big screener. If you were looking at a country and if the political system is unstable, you just don't go there, even if everything else is okay, because you may end up absolutely losing your company altogether. So that's the number one important thing. If that's not right, you don't touch it. If that's right, then you start to look at some of these other ones. So you've got this domestically, you've got this internationally, and then you've got this in every single country you go into, which is why in 50 minutes, all I'm going to be able to let you know is what you don't know. Okay? So all of these things in every country are going to change, probably. The one I'm going to focus on today is culture, because it's the one that's most interesting to me. It's the one in a way that all of these things can also be wrapped into culture, and that's what I'm going to try to do, is touch upon all these different things. So just to give you an idea of how culture can really mess a company up. And I'll give you some examples. These are not small companies. These are companies who should have known better, that have made mistakes. But little things that you wouldn't know. There was an American floor wax company. They were in Brazil, and they were doing really, really well. They changed the formula, and all of a sudden, their sales plummeted. And they couldn't understand. They'd made a more effective product, and all of a sudden, their sales plummeted. What they found was that people were not using it as a floor wax. They were using it to ignite their barbecues. And when it became a more effective floor wax, it became a less effective ignition of their barbecues. So they didn't even know what people were using for it. Who would know that Germans prefer their salad dressing in a tube? It's just not something you would really think about unless you'd gone in there and known to ask for it. Mountain Dew, right? I have a hard time just with a British accent, so I would say Mountain Dew, which doesn't sound right. But Mountain Dew would be hard to pronounce in Portuguese, and they went in and they found it, and they found, just like me, people couldn't ask for it because they couldn't say the word with a Portuguese dialect. This will happen in many, many countries in Europe. It's changing. Things are becoming bigger, and things are becoming more Americanized, and those of you that have traveled recently will see that. I've been in this country 22 years, and I've really noticed a difference in the last 10 years when I go home to England. Everything is becoming more homogenous. Everything is becoming really more Americanized. But in more remote areas, you'll find that people have small homes, they have small fridges, and a 2-liter bottle of Coke. They don't even have that little slot in the door where the 2-liter bottle of Coke fits in that we all assume is going to be there. It's not even there. You can't even fit it there, so you can't sell them in foreign countries. Again, things you need to know. Deodorant is always an interesting one that travelers always like to comment on. There's a little difference in preference in terms of whether you should use deodorant or not. But actually what you find when you go to Europe, it's not that people don't use deodorant, it's that they tend to use, what's the most common form of deodorant here?
Stick,
right? You go to Europe and it's not sticks. It would tend to be roll-ons and sprays, which if you've used them are not just not as effective. So it's not that people don't use it, it's that they tend to use a different form. But if you're P&G going into that market, you've either got to learn how to change their behavior or develop a form of that product that people will want to buy, right? So you need to know these things. This is one that I got in one of these books, Kellogg's Pop-Tarts Failed in Europe as Many Homes Do Not Have a Toaster, which is just not true, right? People have toasters. I grew up with a toaster all my life. We're not that primitive. So why do you think Kellogg's Pop-Tarts might have failed? We have toasters. They're quite small, though. But that might be one thing in some. If you had a toaster, yeah, that was a different size. That certainly happened in some. Dishwashers, for example, going into Japan, they had to completely modify the dishwasher because the dishwasher had to be small. And they had different types of implements going into there. So they had to change those kinds of things. Has anybody eaten breakfast? Yeah, you know, this would be considered absolute rubbish for breakfast, Pop-Tart. You would never have a Pop-Tart. You don't have donuts for breakfast either. It's just a different type of breakfast. And if you're going to other parts of Europe, you'd find, again, their food is very culturally embedded. And food is a very hard one to get right, and changing people. One of the projects I love to do in my class is to have students take either peanut butter or iced tea to other countries. And they assume the whole world loves peanut butter because they love peanut butter and they had it their whole lives. And so it's just a matter of convincing them to eat peanut butter. I have never made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in my life. It's something I didn't grow up with. I'm coming here in my 20s. That's not when you would start eating a PB&J. So it's not endemic to my culture. Just like, has anybody here heard of Vegemite? Anybody? Vegemite?
Chopped vegetables.
With some brewer's yeast and some other yucky stuff in there. Have you heard it?
Australian.
It's Australian, and it's in 99% of pantries in the U.S., in Australia. But there's not a one of you that would want to touch. If I made you eat it, you'd never eat it again. I made my students eat it, and I always have to bring something sweet and nice for them to eat afterwards. But it's the equivalent of our peanut butter. But again, people grew up with it. It's very, very healthy for you. But Americans just wouldn't eat it. Unless you were a health nut, you wouldn't eat it by choice. But again, it's part of your culture. So these are the things that are very difficult to learn. But as a marketer, what we're trying to do, there's this whole debate about standardization versus adaptation. There was a professor at Harvard called Theodore Levitt who in the 1960s said that the world is becoming more and more homogenous, and so let's start treating markets as the same, right? And there are benefits to doing it. So he was on the idea of let's standardize. Let's try and market the product in the same way in every country. And then other people were saying, no, we need to localize. There are differences, and we have to acknowledge those differences. Now, the reason you would want to standardize, this is very lecture here. I'll just talk off it. But basically, if you think about it, it's cheaper. If you don't change it for every country you go into, if you have the same advertising, an ad costs about $100,000 to produce, and then you've got to do the buys. So you save that $100,000 if you can find a way to do it the same way. If you keep the product the same way, you're going to save things. You also want to have the same brand image in different countries. For example, if you were to go to, probably about 5 years ago, if you were to go to England and you wanted to buy a Snickers bar, let's say you couldn't do without your Snickers bar, do you know what it would have been called there? It's called a Marathon bar, which they've actually now brought into this market as an energy bar, if you see it, with the same colors. A Mars bar would be a Milky Way. It still is. And they're all mixed up. Three Musketeers is a Milky Way in the UK. So all the names are different. You don't know what bar you're getting when you open your wrapper. So that's one of the problems if you don't standardize. If you standardize, people know what they're getting, right, as you go through there. But there are problems. What we're going to talk about today are the differences in every country, and it's very easy to mess up. It's very easy to ignore cultural differences, to ignore needs. One of the things I talk about in my class is just a bicycle. If you think of how many of you have bicycles? How many of you travel to work every day on a bicycle? Okay, very different than if you were in the Netherlands, for example, where you get out of the train station and there's basically a parking lot full of bicycles. And people bike to and from everywhere they go. So they need to have baskets on the front. They need something to hold their groceries on the back. That's very different from going back and forth to campus or just going for a 20-mile bike, right? So again, just understanding what the needs are in different countries, you're going to have changes. Okay, I'm going to actually go through this a little bit. Self-reference criterion, this is the thing that we all need to worry about. It's like the fish doesn't know it's wet. How do you know when you're referring to your own culture? It's what's endemic to you. It's what feels right to you. So somehow we have to do this academic exercise, which is what I'll be talking about today, of knowing what you don't know and knowing what to look for. It's sort of like the one that probably you hear most about is Japan. You hear lots of things about business etiquette with Japan. For example, have any of you heard about the business card exchange in Japan? The business card is sacred, right? Whereas we might get somebody's business card, and we might look at it, and we might put it in our pocket, or we might turn it over and write out their number on it. You would have offended somebody to the point where they would leave a meeting if you were to do that in Japan. If you go to Japan and they will immediately look at your title, if your title is not high enough and equitable to them, the meeting's over. So there are all these different things that are you just don't know what you're going to mess up, right? So you have to be trained in these. But at least if you know that there are things you need to look for, then you can look for those things. So I wanted to give you an example here. I don't know if you can see this well in the lighting, but how you would take an ad and how it would need to be changed slightly for different countries. This is for the men's cologne, Dracar Noir. And if you see it here, this is a print ad, and it says, feel the power. And if you see here, there's a man holding the cologne with a woman with nicely manicured nails holding his wrist like this. And then there's a speedboat, and then there's a very muscular arm here, and he's got a strong bow, and it's all very powerful. Right, very powerful as you go through. And then there's a guy on the top skiing. So it's all about strength and power and vitality. And this same ad, they still wanted to keep the idea, but they realized they needed to change it for different countries. So this is what they did in Spain. If you notice, all of that athleticism is gone. All of the power is gone. And they actually changed the skin tone of the models to reflect the more Spanish skin tone. And so they changed it up a little bit. You'll see some font. And here you have Saudi Arabia. Very different from what you would have. For a start, they formalize it, and they put the man in the tux. And then there could never be this suggestion of a woman having any kind of power over man, the woman just suggesting being able to hold their wrist. So again, it's a little bit more flirtatious, a little bit more suggestive than it would be in the US and in Spain. But they've still kept the same theme, the same elements of it, okay, as you go through. So if you think about culture, your culture is learned. What we think about being right and wrong is endemic to the fact that we were born in this country. So those of you who were born in the US have one idea of what is right and wrong, what are your values, what your norms are. I was born in a different country, so mine are slightly different. But they're all shaped by what happens to you in your life and who you're around in your life, who your peers are as you go through. So these are the norms and the values. And these are the things that really shape those. And I'm going to give you a world tour through some of these as we go through them. And I'm going to try and just show you lots of pictures rather than lots of points, but just to try and illustrate how these can be different. So if you look at all of these, probably one of the biggest one and the most obvious one is language as you travel from country to country. If you think about the country of India, do any of you know how many languages there are in India? Anyone want to guess? More? 3,000. To the point where they can't tell between a dialect and a language. So you think about just putting out a national print ad. Which language do you pick? They have 12 national languages. 12 national languages. We have one. 12. If you think about employing a salesperson, you have to do them into specific regions, very regionalized, because they can't speak one language from one to the other. So there are all these different issues that you have there. The social structure, again, India, you think about the idea of the extended family. I mean, you think of Sam's Club and Costco, it's just made for India, if you think about it. You buy everything in bulk like this, except they have to go on the bus, so that doesn't work. Religion, obviously, is a very big shaper of norms and values, and that changes from country to country. The political philosophy, where you're talking about a capitalistic society, a planned economy, obviously, that's going to vary. Economics has a big, big emphasis, especially on things like segmentation and pricing, which is pretty obvious. And then education. So I'm going to sort of flip through these a little bit. This is the global population. This is the world. And the population of the world at the moment is at 6.5 billion. 1 billion of those are in India. And if you saw the income distribution there, they probably have about 1/20th of what we have in terms of income. So you have all of these developing regions where you have lots of people but with lower incomes. And then you have the developed regions, again, fewer people but with higher incomes. So trying to market a product is very different. So for example, Michael Jordans, let's say you have Air Max Michael Jordans. Anybody know how much they cost? Ridiculously inflated. So you're talking about $120, right, for a pair of shoes. Are you going to be able to sell those in India?
I wouldn't think so.
So what could you do? You still want to sell some shoes. What can Nike do? Okay. Okay, make them in India. They're probably making them in China anyway, right? Even the ones that are $120. But you're certainly going to try to lower your costs because if you're bringing down your price, you don't want to do your margin. One of the most famous names in the world, even in China, the most famous name in the world. If they actually did some research, the most recognizable name in the world. But what they found is that they don't need all those bells and whistles. So what you would see if you went to India is, if you remember, everybody here probably remembers John McEnroe was probably the one who made Nike probably the one of the most. If you remember the shoe that he wore when he won Wimbledon, that's the shoe that you'll see. It's actually come back around here now, which is sort of strange, but that's the shoe that we see. You take the features off of it, you make it affordable for people, and you still have your same margins as you go through there. The other benefit is that when it's basically obsolete here, you can then sell it in those markets, so you have a second market for your products as you go through there. The other thing to remember is, even though there's a small percentage of people that make a good deal of money in India, they do exist. For example, I had a friend when I was doing my PhD who had a butler, they had a maid, and they had that kind of living because the cost of living is low. But even if the small percentage, it's a small percentage of 1 billion people, so it's still a decent market as you're going in there. So you can't take anything on face value as you go through here. This is just giving you an idea of, again, life expectancy. And I do an exercise in my class, having them to think about this and think about what that would mean for the type of products that you would provide there. So if you think about the silver market or the senior market in this country, which is one of the biggest markets, in many markets, it just doesn't exist. I mean, people just don't live that long. So you have to think about, what do you do if you have a product that's designed for seniors? How do you modify it as you go in there? This is a little different. It talks about the age distribution. And if you think about targeting different consumers, we do it an awful lot on age. Every movie that's made is made for a certain age demographic, usually teens, unfortunately. But if you look at this, it would give you an idea of, again, whether you should go into different markets or not, whether you need to change up the product. So you need to make it younger or older as you're going through here. So if you look at Kenya, for example, you'll see the age distribution, obviously this is partly to do with the life expectancy, but you'll see if they tend to be skewed one way or the other. So you have the UK, which is, it's pretty uniform as you go up through the ages. So you're going to have a strong market. What this is great for is something like cohort marketing. Has anybody heard that term? How many of you drink Coke pretty regularly? Okay, what used to happen if you go back a generation was that when you get to about your 40s, you stop drinking Coke and you start drinking coffee, right? You grow up into the older ones. And that stopped happening, and people, it became this idea that the product stayed with you as you went through your years. So they had to sort of move with you. So the idea of cohort marketing is that you stay with that same age group and they keep trying to market at you. Because if you think about the cigarette manufacturers, it's what they're counting on. They get you in your teens and they've got you for life, hopefully, as you're going through there. But these are the different things that you would look at as you go through here. The Big Mac Index, God forbid that everything is now measured on the Big Mac Index, but the Economist magazine, after it actually came up with this as a way of measuring different incomes in different countries, how much would a Big Mac cost in each country? And this takes into account the cost of living, how much would it cost to make a Big Mac, how much would people earn? So this actually tells you, based on the wages that people would make in each country, how much a Big Mac would cost. And it is just a couple of caveats here. Globally, people would have to work for 35 minutes to afford a Big Mac. And you can do your own math in your own head to think about how long you would have to work at your salary to be able to afford a Big Mac. In New York, 13 minutes. And that's pretty much average across the whole USA. So 13 minutes of work, you'll get your Big Mac. In Geneva, 15 to 20 minutes. It's not because they make more, it's because it costs more to make a Big Mac there. So people earn more, the costs of production are more. So a Big Mac is actually more expensive. So they're still making good wages, but it's more expensive. In Nairobi, it's the opposite. It doesn't cost much to make a Big Mac, but they earn so little that they're gonna have to actually work for an hour and a half every day to earn a Big Mac, which might not be a bad thing if we had to work for an hour and a half before we could afford a Big Mac. But. So you see these differences. There's something called purchasing power parity, which does a similar type of thing. And what it tries to do is, instead of just looking at somebody's income, they look at the cost of living in different countries to see how much people really are earning as you go in there. Okay, this is where I have some interesting pictures to show you. This is when you're talking about distribution, and I told you how difficult it was in different countries. This is the norm in some countries. This was actually in India. So this is how they move things around. So if you wonder how you're going to get something back from Sam's next time you're there, just think hard enough and you'll get it home. This is moving day as you're going through here. So they overpacked a little bit here. These are real pictures of people moving product as you're going through here. This was a truck that just overloaded a little bit too much as you're going through here. Now, when you go into these countries, you can't bring your trucks and you can't bring your trains. This is what's available to you. So you've somehow got to figure this out. How are you going to move it? And you can't get much on there either. They're trying to get a lot on there, but obviously they can't get much on there. So we're used to, in the US, does anybody know what the main way of shipping cargo around is? In the US, it's actually train. It's actually freight. If you were to go to Europe, most train would actually be passenger, and it would be, they use truck. And there's a reason for this. The train system is actually quite complex. For example, if you were trying to, you'd think, okay, going from France to Spain, that's, you know, compared to moving other parts of the world, that's pretty simple. If you were moving something in a train, you would actually have to get it off the French train. You would then have to get it over and repack it onto a Spanish train. Does anybody know why that would be?
Different gauge.
6 inches different and messes you up enough. So how much does that add to your cost and to your time? So you're not going to do it. You're going to send a truck there instead. So there are big differences. If you think about this in China, this is how they move product around. Can you imagine how many of these you're going to have to fill up to try to get to your customers? But again, you've got to deal with what you have. This is in China, and they found that they needed more. This was a distribution warehouse. They needed to extend it, so here come the tarps. So again, think about your product and think about how you would have to package your product so it could exist in this kind of environment. We're used to air-conditioned warehouses. They're sticking with a piece of tent over them. So again, you have to be aware. And obviously, you'd need to go there and you would need to see this. I actually got these pictures from a colleague of mine, Tom Spey, who's actually one of the top logisticians in the world, who travels to these countries quite often and comes in and talks to my students. So he usually brings back these. How about trying to sell something in here? This is in Bangkok. You'd have a very similar situation in Vietnam and other places. And all it is simply a lean-to on the side of the road. And what you'll notice here, if you look at it, is everything is in very small packages. P&G found, usually these small packages are a result of people realizing that the big ones don't work, unless they're local. So P&G have gone in with the big ones and then realized this isn't working. So in Vietnam, for example, if you were to go to one of these, you'd find tiny little sachets of Head & Shoulders, tiny little sachets of Pantene, because that's what people can afford to buy each time they go to the store. They can't afford this, nor do they have room for it in their houses. So as a result of mistakes, they've realized how they need to change things up. So we're not used to that. We're used to buying a big bulk, and we use it until we run out. So again, just being aware of how things are different as you go in there. This is a special display, mind you. This is one they're trying to actually give it to actually push. So if you go into a Moscow supermarket, have any of you ever been to Russia? It's a very, very interesting place. I actually went, and we take a summer business school program over there. So I went for 2 weeks. And the system there in the supermarkets is you basically go, and you decide what you want to buy. And then you get them to write it down on a piece of paper. And then you have to go pay for it. And then you have to go back and give them the piece of paper and get your item. So 5 hours later, you've finally gotten everything. It's that slow. It's unbelievable. Each item, you go pay for it, you bring it back, and you pick up your item. So a very different idea. So you're thinking of a modern business, and you're thinking of P&G. They've still got it in that environment. So this is the equivalent of our end-of-aisle displays and all the big things that we do around in our grocery stores. This is what they do to really push a product in Moscow. Here's an example of Walmart. If you think about Walmart, obviously, Sam Walton made his fortune on the idea of distribution. He stripped it down. He took out the middleman. And then suddenly they go into a place like São Paulo, and they find that exists, that infrastructure just doesn't exist there. So they've gone from making seven, which they would in the US, seven deliveries a day, to having to make 300 deliveries a day just to try and get enough product there for the type of stores that they have. So distribution is probably the most difficult thing to actually get around. We're still talking about economics a little bit. So are you all right? I know I'm throwing stuff at you, but we're going to go around the world in 50 minutes here as we go through. So just to give you again for pricing, if you look here, you'll see pretty much across the board, Tokyo is actually the most expensive for all these products. And Tokyo is known. Nobody goes to Tokyo for a bargain unless it's some kind of hot item that you have in the side alley. But what you'll see here is that pretty much across the board, if you look at those, Tokyo's prices are higher. To the point where eventually the Japanese realized that they could actually buy abroad and pay to have it shipped in cheaper than actually buying it here. And in marketing, we call that a gray market. It's not a black market. It's not illegal. But it's certainly not what the vendors in Japan want them to be doing. So that's what they found. I mean, look at the price. This is the rent for if you want to rent a two-bedroom apartment in Tokyo. For 1 month, it's going to cost you $6,000 as you go through there. So very difficult. This is an example here. Again, I wanted to get into the blunders a little bit. And I'm not sure if any of you have heard. You've heard of Cadbury Schweppes, the company. They make the chocolate. They make a lot of drinks. It's a big multinational corporation. And they actually wanted to try and tell people that this new chocolate bar, Cadbury's Temptations, you just couldn't resist it. So they decided they would hitch on something that was very topical, which somebody there hopefully got fired for this. They decided it should be about Kashmir. And Kashmir is an area of land between Pakistan and India that they have had wars over for since the two countries basically were put together. And there's a religious overtone to it because you have mostly Hindu India with mostly Muslim Pakistan. They decided for some reason that this would be a good thing to have a little joke about. So they actually got an ad with a map of Kashmir, and they said, I'm good. This was not the guy. This is from their website, but this is the bar. I'm good. I'm tempting. I'm too good to share. What am I, Cadbury's Temptations or Kashmir? And it caused an absolute upheaval. They put it over the map of Kashmir. And they also decided, for another bright idea, to actually put it out on Indian Independence Day. So it was a day when they were feeling very nationalistic as it was. And then you're going to do this. So they had to make all sorts of apologies, which again, they didn't do well. But here you have an enormous multinational corporation that doing something like this. Diageo, which is a company, one of the biggest alcohol distributors in the world, decided that they would, for some reason, the Taiwanese would find it funny if they had an ad which basically mocked their idea of they produce shoddy merchandise, which we all would often joke about the made in Taiwan. Obviously, that's funny everywhere but Taiwan, right? But Diageo decided it might be funny there. And then in India again, Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, they actually for some reason thought it would, they drew paintings for their ads on the side of the Himalaya Mountains, ecologically protected. Again, these are the type of faux pas that hindsight you would wonder how anybody could do it, but it's difficult to do. I'm going to segue into language, and I'm sure you're all familiar with JFK's famous speech which said, Ich bin ein Berliner, which he thought meant, I'm also a Berliner, I'm also from Berlin. This is actually an ad from a company who pointed out the fact that actually Ich bin ein Berliner in German dialect would actually mean I am a donut. Donut is actually, Berliner is actually dialect for donut. So we're all still thinking it was the best speech ever. He actually used the wrong words as you're going in there. So this is my segue into language. And when you talk about language, you talk about verbal and nonverbal as you're going through here. So language, as I told you, you've got 3,000 languages, and they say that language is a mirror of a culture. So if you think about Switzerland, does anybody know how many languages are spoken there?
Five major ones.
Okay, so we've got Italian?
French.
Yeah, those are the four that I'm aware of as a national language. If you go to Belgium, you have Flemish, and you have French that are spoken there equally. So what we tend to do when you think about research, sorry.
I'm sorry, I was just thinking out loud. Italian? Did you mention Italian?
In Switzerland, yeah. So there are there. And what research tend to do is that if it's a different language, it's a different culture. So that's usually the way we would break it down as you go through that. And you can think about the same thing happening in the U.S. with different subcultures. Certainly the cultures come along with it. The thing that is very difficult if you're doing international marketing is figuring out the nonverbals, figuring out the body language. And I gave you the example of in Japan. Japan is probably the easiest one to do things wrong because they have such a high context language, which means basically it's not what you say, it's the way that you say it. So if any of you have watched, for example, the samurai movies or the Bruce Lee movies, you've seen this idea of saving face. The idea that you never bring shame onto anybody or cause embarrassment. Well, the Japanese think that saying no to somebody basically causes them to lose face. So they simply don't do it. They don't say no in Japanese. They have 16 different ways of saying yes that mean no. So they never actually say it. So you have to know when they're saying no, even though they're saying yes. So you can imagine that, especially if your Japanese is a little shaky. So what it comes to is the body language. It's the way they say it. And it's a very, very high context language as you go in there. And then in the 1960s, there was a guy called Edward T. Hall that came up with this idea of silent languages, which is the language of space. And I'll talk a little bit about this, but we actually use those to interpret things, and you may not realize that we actually do it. So just to give an example here of how tricky language is, this is from my own language here. I have to do this every day where I have to translate the language back and forth. When my family comes to visit me from England, I have to go back again. So it's my vocabulary that changes. My accent is pretty American, but my vocabulary changes. So my 9-month-old still wears a nappy. I don't say diaper that often. But all these different words, this is just English to American, if you think about it. So imagine when you're going to other countries as you're going through there. So there's probably some, maybe you're, I don't know if you're aware. For example, eggplant is aubergine. Would anybody have a clue what they were asking you if you wanted some aubergine, some roasted aubergine? No, you wouldn't even know it. We tend to have, instead of having garage sales, we have car boot sales, which is basically where everybody goes to, we call it a car park. You park your car, everybody opens the car boot, which is the trunk, and you sell away. That's how you do it. So a slightly different way of doing it. And then you have something, there's some expressions here. You don't ever want to ask somebody, you know, the idea of knocking you up. Well, I used to play tennis, and when you would warm up, we would actually call that knocking up. So it was actually a very common phrase. I realized that's not something I should ask somebody here when I came to play college tennis. So some of the phrases are different. If somebody calls you a jammy dodger, it actually means you're lucky. And then there's apples and pears. There's Cockney rhyming slang. I know if any of you have watched My Fair Lady, you might have seen a little bit of that coming out of Eliza Doolittle. But Cockney rhyming slang, actually what you do is you take this rhyme and then it rhymes with the actual word. So then you have a clue. If I said I was going up the apples and pears, I'm going up the stairs. right? If it's cold, I'm going to grab my nanny goat, which is my coat. But I'd probably just shorten it and say, I'm just going to grab my nanny, which starts to sound a little strange. And then you would say, I want to get on the dog and bone, which is the phone. Now, it's old. It's old Cockney, but people still use it. My dad was a Cockney. He would still refer to some of these things. So again, if you were going to be going in and working with people, you need to be aware of that. Okay, I wanted to give you an example here. These are actually foreign brand names of products. And if you read through them, you have some, these are real names. So you have a French foil wrap called Alufani. So it's not just about going into other countries, it's other countries coming in here. You've got Atom Bomb, which was actually a Portuguese tuna. Bull, which was a French computer foil. Crapsy Fruit, I've actually seen that one in France quite a bit. Again, you probably wouldn't do too well with that if you came into the US. Happy End, quite adequate. I mean, it is descriptive. German toilet paper. Kack, which is a Danish sweet. Come On It, which is a German pencil sharpener. You've got Muck, which is Italian yogurt. Plop. You've got Pocari Sweat and Cow Piss, which are sports drinks in Japan. Poo, which is maybe descriptive again of arginine curry powder. You've got Shit with a P. And these are all just very, these are just in their language. So again, the issue is that what does it mean when it comes into this language? And the very famous one, I think, for that you may have heard it in the opposite direction is Coca-Cola when they went into China. In the typical way of thinking, we're a big multinational, we're going to go in as Coca-Cola. They went in. Has anybody heard the story of what Coca-Cola meant? Coca-Cola, when said, because you're going to say it in Chinese, and so it's going to have meaning in Chinese, meant bite the wax tadpole. Yeah, you're going to sell lots of cans of that. So they now actually have changed it to something that sounds like Coca-Cola, and it means enjoyment in the mouth or happiness in the mouth in Chinese, as you say it. Okay, so this whole idea of what do we change and what do we stay the same, it gets very prickly. You want to keep things the same, but again, you have to be careful about what it might mean here. I'm going to give you a few more. These are just a few more examples here of companies. Look at the companies. Coors, one of the biggest companies in the world. Turn It Loose, somebody with Spanish 101 decided it should be some language which says suffer from diarrhea. We've got a few of these. If any of you are aware of Electrolux, Electrolux is a Scandinavian vacuum cleaner. Strangely, in Europe, they call all vacuum cleaners Hoovers, which gets a little complicated. So it's actually an Electrolux Hoover. And they came into the US, they decided they had a campaign that worked so well in Europe, we're going to bring it in here. So they decided they would show the power of an Electrolux by nothing sucks like an Electrolux. It's easier to see them when you see them in our language. This is an example just of how unwieldy something can be when you take it into another language. So just Salem Feeling Free. Two words, very simple. When you go into Japanese, is when smoky Salem, you will feel so refreshed that your mind seems to be free and empty. Again, not the snappy tagline that you might want to have next to your board. This again was unfortunate. Colgate decided to introduce, it's sort of the equivalent of brushing your teeth with Hustler over here. So they changed that once they realized that there was actually a porno magazine with the same brand name. This was probably the most fragrant claim. Come Alive with the Pepsi generation, when they took it into Chinese, became actually Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the grave. So if you're a believer, that's the product for you. And this is my favorite. Frank Perdue went into Latin America. And you've all heard that it takes a strong man to make a tender chicken. Translated a little too literally, it takes an aroused man to make a chicken affectionate. And that was actually what was on their print advertising as you go through there. So again, it's all about, we talk about back translation. So what they should have done was translate it into Spanish and then have somebody translate it back into English and then see if it's changed or not. But they cut costs. They want to keep things as quick as they can. And this is one. There was a claim here that the Parker pen won't leak in your pocket and embarrass you. So they had a mechanism where it wouldn't leak. Again, the person with Spanish 101 decided that embarrass, okay, that must be embarrassar, so I'll use that verb. Embarrassar, unfortunately, means to make you pregnant. So what they claimed was that it won't leak in your pocket and make you pregnant, which is important in a pen, but I'm not sure it's really what they were going for as you go through there. So nonverbal communication. In this country, if I were to say this, what would this mean? Yeah, it's good, right? I mean, it's okay. If you were to go into southern France, if I came out of a meeting and I said this, would basically mean everything is off. It's useless. Nothing's going on. If I were to do it in Brazil, it's actually an expletive. So be careful. If don't get it too enthusiastic when you're traveling around now. So the idea that different gestures that we tend to take for granted, there are some universals, like this is going to be a drink wherever you go. This might be that you're thirsty. There are something that universal, but some things that change as you go from country to country. So it's not what you say, it's how you say it. So you think about it, for example, with space. Right, when you now you're all now being out in the world. So, where did you want the office that you have? Where did you want it to be? When you were graduating and you pictured your office, where was it? Was it on the bottom floor, corner office? Okay. Top, right? Penthouse is always at the top. Windows, hopefully. We give meaning to space, right? So there's this idea of where you are. I don't know if any of you have seen if you've seen the movie. I've gone blank. All right, forget that line. There's a movie where the guy ends up in the basement. He just gets diminished and diminished and diminished. Office Space, thank you. So this one poor guy who turns out he'd lost his job ages ago, but the whole thing is just demeaning him to where he finally ends up in a tiny little cramped space in the basement. That speaks to how we communicate with space, right? The president always has the biggest office. The rap star is always on the penthouse. It's this idea, again, of the importance of space. So Hall Silent Language does this. If you go, does anybody know, if I were to stand next to you, how close to you I could get before I started to make you uncomfortable?
3 feet.
3 feet? If we were to go to a Latin American country, would that get bigger or smaller?
Smaller.
How about the UK, just so you know how close you can get to me? You got to give me 6 more inches. I start to get squirmy. So it's 3.5 inches. So Hall actually went and found what that was. So I actually do an experiment with my students before I introduce this and have them talk to each other and get closer and closer. The guys are practically leaning out the window. I've actually had them open the window and lean out so they didn't have to get too close while they were talking. So you could test where that space was. And you may have wondered why, for example, if you travel around the country, if we were sitting in the bus, if you remember the buses that took you around campus, if we're sitting in the bus and you're sitting there on your seat and somebody else gets on, we would think it was sort of odd if the whole bus is empty, right? I mean, the idea is, okay, you split the distance between me and the end and you go sit halfway back there. Whereas if you go to another country, they may sit right next to you, right? And that's what's the norm. For us, it may make us very uncomfortable. So again, when you're in business meetings, you need to be aware you may offend somebody by sitting apart from them, or you may offend them by sitting too close. So again, understanding what those are. Other things, for example, the Germans are quite easy to insult as well. For example, for the men, if you were to introduce yourself with your hand in your pocket, and a lot of people here, if you think about it, you talk with your hand in your pocket, you even present with your hand in your pocket. Very, very insulting to them. If you were in Japan and you were to sit, and so for example, I'll pick on you, Dave, how you're sitting right there. So Dave's got his foot on his knee. In Japan, why would that be a no-no? Bottom of the shoe. It's considered to be disrespectful to show the bottom of your shoe as you're going through there. All things, who would know? Okay, so again, it's just knowing the things that you need to look for as you go through that. How am I doing for time? Okay. Religion. While we can talk about the influence of religion on values and attitudes, I'm a marketer, so I'm going to talk about the influences on when we buy and what we buy. So Mattel Toys actually was going in, decided they were going to enter the Dutch market, so they decided they were going to go in and hit it big for Christmas, because that's when people bought their Christmas toys. So when do you think would be a good idea to go in there and start really pushing the product?
Early November.
Okay, which is when they went, in November. They missed the market altogether, because what they didn't know is while the Dutch celebrate Christmas, they exchange gifts on December 5th. Okay, so it's not just when the religious holiday is, but when the actual gift-giving is. So you'll see here, December 6th, sorry. So in Russia, you've got Frostman's Day is actually when they exchange gifts. Ramadan is I know we're all pretty familiar with Ramadan. Ramadan is the holiday where you fast from sun up to sundown, right, as you go through there. So what you find is, for example, if people are very devout, there's an example there of how the market slips in Tunisia because everybody is devout and everybody's energy is low and people aren't working in the same way. But after Ramadan, there's a period of enormous gift giving. So it's actually a time when then sales go way up. And again, it's understanding that and realizing it. I have an example here of, again, a big faux pas. In Mecca, which is where Muslims go to go for their pilgrimages, they decided that they needed to improve the infrastructure there. So they did it the way everybody does, and they actually got bids. They found that a Swedish company won the bids. They were the cheapest ones who were going to do it, but there was a problem. Anybody know what the problem will be there? Swedish company in Mecca improving the infrastructure?
Women driving.
I'll let you go on that one. We're going to assume they had some very good Swedish women drivers, as there are good American women drivers. But women would certainly be an issue, right? So let's say women employees is one. It's even more fundamental than that, but you're on the right line. How many Swedish Muslims do you think they had on their crew? There can be no non-Muslims in Mecca. So here they had allowed a European country. So what they had to do was set up a closed-circuit TV, employ Muslims to go in there and do the work, and all the Swedish managers had to sit outside of the city looking at the TV and actually directing them, which you can imagine how much that added to their costs after they actually did it. It's just basic things as you go through. Okay, education is another thing. I like to do this. This is probably more impactful on my students than it is on you. But what I wanted to show them here is, here's the United States. This is 1997, and unfortunately things haven't gotten any better. It might have slipped even further down the list. This is on math and on science, if you look at the world order in terms of education. Look at Japan, and you see Singapore has actually headed the list for both of these. So when you think about technology and why Asia and Europe are driving technology, you can maybe start to see what's happening here. This is another reason, and students just love to see this, because while the Japanese are number three, it's because they simply work more. This is actually a question which asked teens how many days a week they would take off for fun and recreation. In the US, most of them would take 1 to 2 or 3 to 4. In Japan, most of them took none. Absolutely no days of the week off. And the Japanese actually go to school on Saturdays as well. I'm not sure these people who didn't know how many days a week they took off. And they must be working so hard. But so again, this gives you an idea of the culture. And then you also have countries where obviously women are simply not allowed to have an education. Or where, if you have the example of Afghanistan, where women teachers were not allowed to teach, so therefore they have no education system. This is going to affect marketing in terms of literacy is the big one. And to give you an example, if you think about your packaging, what would a marketer need to do if people can't read? Pictures, right. So let's say you're going into Africa, you're going to rely on pictures, which is exactly what Gerber. So Gerber was going into Africa, and they have a little baby. So I have a little baby right now. I've got lots of little Gerber jars in them. And what the Africans would infer is whatever is pictured on the label is what is in the package. That's how they communicated it. Gerber didn't know this, didn't change up the label. What's on a Gerber? A baby, and it's, you know, that carrot is sort of mushy orange, right? And there's some that are very skin-like. They actually thought it was liquidized baby that was in there. Again, a simple thing, but it was their norm. That was their habit, that's how they communicated. If you do market research in countries that have low literacy, you have to use what we call the smiley face scale, which is when you want people's reaction to things, you give them smiley faces and ask them how they feel about it because they can't indicate it by reading or writing. So again, just knowing how to adapt it. If you're talking about it being non-literate, you're maybe going to use billboards, which are more visual, than you will use, obviously you're not going to use the newspaper, they're not reading, but using print ads. So again, knowing the culture that you're going into is going to change things up. I wanted to show you just some pictures of different kitchens. This is actually by a whole new company that's put this together. And what they have done is gone around the world and just pictured people's homes and developed a database of 90,000 images. And what marketers then, if you think about, for example, if Procter & Gamble were going in, this is what they do, what their managers do when they go to different places. But now they brought it to them. And by looking at their kitchens, they can infer how they live. They can infer what their aesthetics are. They can infer what they need. So I gave you the example, for example, of a dishwasher in Japan. How would you think, let's say you were Maytag and you needed to change up your dishwasher. What things would you need to take into consideration?
Space,
power, costs. Okay, space is a big one. So they've come up with this one that sits on top of the countertop. Because there's no, here if you build a house, you build a big space there, right, for our dishwashers would have to be there. That doesn't exist in Japan, so they have a small one. If you go to Germany, they like to have the water, some have the water going in hot, some have it going in cold and getting heated as it goes in there. So you have to know that norm. What do they tend to eat more than anything in Japan? Rice. Have you ever left rice sitting there for a day on your dish and then tried it? So they had to make the jets far more powerful in Japan because of the type of food that they eat. Okay, so just small little things that you need to know as you're going in there. Have I hit time or how am I? Couple minutes, okay. As you're going through here, this is a little thing a bit like, this is sort of culturally relevant here, but when Hong Kong When the British released Hong Kong, so it now went back to China, there's an enormous economic difference between Hong Kong and China, and a very big cultural difference, obviously, if you think about the exposure to the Western world. So this company came up with rice paddy babies, which were along the lines of our Cabbage Patch dolls, if anybody remember these. But the whole idea was that the people from Hong Kong could adopt their relatives from China. So they actually got to adopt a doll with the passport, with all their adoption papers. So here was a company who really took advantage of that change as you're going through there. And these were the hottest thing in Hong Kong that you could get for a long time. I just wanted to give you an example here again of the different norms and attitudes that you have in different countries. So this is Colac laxative. And this is just to illustrate how both doing research and selling a product needs to be changed. So here's a laxative. They wanted to go in and they wanted to talk to people about constipation. And what they found is that there was no way anybody from Japan was going to talk to anybody from the US about their constipation. That just wasn't going to happen. So they knew that they had to, if they had focus groups, they had to have moderators who were American. They also found that people just weren't happy with what they had. They had these herbal remedies, and they thought that they were too slow-acting, and they weren't happy with them. But they were worried. They were worried that these Western medicines would be too chemical and be too strong, which can be another problem. So they were worried about that. So what they decided to do, they didn't change the product in any way in terms of what was actually in it. What they did is just make it smaller. And so it appeared more natural. So instead of taking one of those big horse pills that you sometimes have to take, they just made it smaller, more concentrated, but smaller. So it gave the impression that it was less strong. And then this was the tagline that went along with it, which, again, you would never use for a laxative. We understand what a laxative is. We understand what we want from a laxative. But they had to try and integrate it as being very natural and very holistic. So this is actually the tagline that they came up with. Three things to consider for stubborn constipation: salad, beauty exercise, and Colac before bedtime. So again, didn't change the product, but changed the way that they marketed it as going there. I'm going to finish on this high here. Anybody have a clue what this product is? In Japan, again, thinking about what is important and what isn't. This is I put down here a deodorizer with a difference. This is a product that actually claims that your bowel movements will not smell if you take this product. And was a big seller, I guess, until people tried it enough times that they decided it wasn't going to work. But again, the etiquette there. This is the last thing I want to show. I have some other stuff on aesthetics, but I'm going to stop here. But again, the idea of what we consider to be beautiful is very different from one culture to another. And it changed very much with packaging. For example, in Japan, you don't sell anything in fours. Does anybody know why that would be? So you don't have a four-pack of anything. It's unlucky. Do you know why that is? It's actually because the word four in Japanese is shushu, and it sounds like the word for death. So nothing is in fours in Japan as you go through there. I wanted to show you this. This is rather drastic, but it actually still, there are still women whose feet were bound like this, and you can hear a lot about it, and actually are quite proud of this legacy. This was at a time when, in order to get the, this is really what the top classes would do. So this is bound like a lily as you go through here. Obviously, they couldn't walk, but they could get a husband as you go through there. How old is she now? She's actually quite young in that picture. So this is maybe in her 30s. But now, this has stopped happening now. But there are still women in their 80s who still hobble around with this. But they're actually quite proud of their legacy. They're proud of the fact that they could sustain the pain. And they actually think that their feet are far more attractive than those that are unbound. So this is a very harrowing example. But again, the idea of what is aesthetically pleasing in some countries is very different from in others. So that was my warp speed travel around the world. It was nice talking to you.